Welcome back. Good morning, James.
We're back.
We're back. And Mark is still with us.
Hey!
Poor guy. He's been on the line for about a month now. He's got a sleeping bag there. It's a bunch of empty Doritos bags all over the place.
Don't forget the fridge with beer.
Yeah, fridge with the beer.
Gotta have the beer fridge. Very important. So we're going to dive back in and hear some more from Mark about Mountain View Hops and his processes there. We'll do our usual housekeeping here first. So again, our Patreon sponsors, thank you so much for following us and sponsoring us. As you've been seeing, I'm very busily posting special Patreon-only information for you. It's usually my venting about my co-host, but mm-hmm. it's still really fun and worth your attention. James didn't hear that, so no worries.
What?
See? Exactly. Exactly. That's how we roll.
Nobody. You say that like I didn't know you were making fun of me behind my back. I mean, come on. That's a given. It's not just you. It's everyone.
That was so not behind your back, though.
Right.
It's right in front of your face.
It is, but if I were paying attention, whatever.
Helps being 800 miles away or whatever
it is. It does, yeah.
So the there's that. Of course, all of you should be following us on Instagram and on Facebook, where we remind you incessantly about our episodes. We're also trying to start some dialogues there, so we'd love to get some more feedback. Likes are great. Likes give us that that endorphin hit. Well documented. We live for our likes. But comments are even better, because if you tell us what you're enjoying or not enjoying, we know what to do on these podcasts. So,
and even, I think, and more importantly, Greg, that like Facebook and these other social media platforms are becoming the go-to forum locations for people to gather information. Mm-hmm. And we know there's a lot of other, hop grower groups and whatnot out there, but they're very much focused on the beer side of hops. And maybe it's an opportunity for people to come to us and ask us very pointed questions about the science and technology, but also the business part of running a hop yard. You don't see that discussed hardly anywhere. So we want to get those dialogue started on our social media platforms so other people can benefit. Because if you guys are having the questions and the issues, I guarantee it other people are too. So we're a community, and let's help each other out.
Absolutely. And if there's anything we're learning from these conversations with Mark, it's that James and I can tell you a lot about things, just like all of us can, about things that go wrong and things that have worked. But hearing more and more perspectives on these things is so valuable. So contribute your perspective. It's going to help someone else. They'll contribute their perspective. It'll help you. Let's build a community together. Everyone hold hands.
Well.
Little too far? Did I go too far?
That requires me to put my beer down, and so that's going to be a problem. Okay, anyway, so the last time, when we last left our heroes, Greg and James were grilling Mark on his business, and poor guy didn't really get any chance to interact with us, so this part D is all about Mark grilling us, so let's just have a conversation and see where it goes.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
You bet.
So the first question I've got has to deal with something I just recently read. Originally, I can't remember the exact dollar amount. It was $10,000 or $20,000. Is the threshold you had to be at before the FDA started monitoring timing of manure applications, if you're using that, or compost. But I just read something here in April, I was put out April this year, stating something to the effect that the FDA is now, they're not going to be regulating that as they start looking into it. So I've got two questions. Is that the case that they now have backed off on that regulation? And the second question is, all I'm seeing is terminology referring to beer. What about wines and ciders and hops going in beer salts and things like that?
Right. Great question. So what you're referring to is the USDA GAP program, Good Agricultural Practices program, that those requirements kick in based on what we call farm gate price. So if you are generating revenue from your crop, and I say profit, but what is the gross revenue greater than $20,000, then you are subject to the USDA's GAP guidelines. Enforcement's a whole nother thing. as we are seeing in the hemp industry where you can make all kinds of rules, but if you can't enforce them, then what's the point, right? The GAP, Good Agricultural Practices ruling, is impactful to any product, frankly, that's going to be consumed raw or be a ingredient component in another foodstuff that has the potential to be consumed raw or have what they consider to be the limited kill steps during processing. So the question right now in brewing, and this has actually been going on for about a decade, but it's just starting to gain steam, is what are the actual kill steps in brewing that would minimize or eliminate the risk of foodborne illnesses? And brewing is saying, well, we boil the wort and all that, it kills everything. Yeah, but you're adding dry hops to the liquid far after the boil. So what is the kill step that keeps those, any microorganisms or cryptosporidia mostly, from hop material from infecting beer and making people sick? That's the big one. So that goes to your manure application timings and whatnot, and knowing what the, basically what the pre-harvest interval is for manure applications, right? So that's sort of the basis of it that still exists, but the ability to enforce that is slim to none.
Well, that answers my question.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Tune in next time. but hops are a food product in all of its phases. So whether it's going into a cider or a wine or hell, even into whiskey, it's still a raw ingredient. Here's the kicker. If you're selling whole cones dried, you fall under good agricultural practices, and that's really your only regulatory hurdle.
And that's $20,000 or so, correct?
Correct. Okay. So farm gate price. So if you're under that, then those regulations don't require to you because they figure that you're not selling enough to really hurt too many people.
And here's a second question. So we use a lot of our hops, of course, in the hop soaks, the hop candy ornaments, things like that. Mm-hmm. So the only portion of my business affected by this GAP rule, I'm assuming, is the ones that go to breweries, wineries, and kombucha.
Welcome to the gray zone.
That's what I was getting at, yep.
So is that 20 grand farm gate price total value that farm is making, or is it to that segment? And that's left open to interpretation.
Oh, I hate gray areas.
Right. Well, that's called the government, and that's what they do. The government wants to tell you that you can't do something, but what they won't tell you is all the things that you can do, because that makes them liable. Because if they say, no, yeah, it's just the stuff that goes to the brewery, and then you're like, oh, fine, I'm under that. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of people get sick or get hurt or something like that. And you say, well, I was under the 20 grand because I only sold $5,000 worth of brewers. And they're like, yeah, that's not what we meant. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's really, really twitchy, that gray zone.
And the reason I ask that is in case people are hearing this podcast and want to start doing some of the things I'm doing, I want them to be informed of that little aspect.
Yeah, quadruple checking my numbers here. I think it's $20,000.
Okay. I tried looking it up. I couldn't find it just this morning, but couldn't remember if it's 10 or 20.
Pretty sure it's 20.
Okay. I'll double check with the extension office.
It's a lot of zeros, but it's not enormous. I mean, it's big enough for anybody who is, think about it in terms of volume. If you're selling $20,000 worth of hops, that's a lot of hops for a small grower. And at that point, it's a lot of potential market touches by that single grower. So that's really where they're coming in to where that number's coming from.
All right. Well, let me give you a little quick pointer on some of my business. Not to give away the business financials again, mm-hmm. but so I can take a gallon bag of loose hop cones mm-hmm. and turn it into $700 to $800 in soaps.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
So, and we're talking thousands of dollars when you go into candle making. Mm-hmm. So that's why I really need to know about, what level and how does it apply to different aspects of my business, because we're going to be approaching that next year and maybe the year after for sure. So that's something, you know, we're going to have to nail down as we grow.
Now, I wonder, and I'm just spitballing here, but it's certainly, if you have one hop yard, there's going to be no way to distinguish between what percentage of that is going to one toward the other. You're either going to have to cover it all or not with with FDA practices. If you had separate plots and one was set aside for a specific part of the business that's not FDA regulated, like the soaps and the candles, I would have to assume that might be a cleaner.
We're talking, let's just make it clear. You guys keep saying FDA. This is USDA.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
So totally different, right? Yeah. Equally pains in the butt. But what if people want to, if people in North America want to Google that, that's what we're talking about is the good agricultural practices gap, which is available online to download for any time you need to be comatose.
That has to be super exciting.
Well, it is for a geek like me, but for, you know, all you cool kids, not so much.
Look, we've had the conversation before that my father, sister, and brother-in-law are all accountants, and Thanksgiving is the most boring situation.
Oh, so you're the black sheep. You're the statistician that they're just like, ooh, rocks.
Exactly.
You're the rock star. You're the statistician. Oh, man. Sadness. Okay. All right. This is not about you. It's about Mark. So.
Yes. Back to Mark.
That's perfectly fine. I enjoy y'all doing these podcasts. This is fun. So this is going to be a question for James, and I'm going to open myself wide open here when I ask you this.
Awesome.
So based on what you've already talked with me and seen my business model and what we're doing currently for the last 2 years in this market, where you've seen where we're wanting to go.
Mm-hmm.
What are your predictions for this business model in this niche market where I'm at? What do you think of this kind of viability, diversification, and all like that? I'd like to get your broad opinion.
Based on what you've shared with us, I would challenge you to justify much more expansion in hops. And my question to you would be, why aren't you expanding into other botanicals for your soap and candle business?
Okay. And by expanding into other botanicals, can you be more specific?
I can, but I don't want to be. No.
Oh, well.
You know, why aren't you looking at lavender? Why aren't you looking at chamomile? Why aren't you looking at, you know, just there's loads of other botanicals that have a lot of value add to your soap making aside from hops. It's okay. Who do you want to be? Are you the hop grower that makes soaps and candles, or are you a candle and soap maker that grows hops?
Good point. So right now that is a fuzzy area and I can't answer that.
Oh, that's fine.
But I do want to do everything hops related. I want to be the person where everything in our business is focused on hops, related to hops, showcasing hops and their uses, not only in brewing, but in other applications.
Right. So I would say, based on what I undersee as the, what we would consider the supplemental market, I would stay away from nutraceuticals. Mm-hmm. So using hops as a, you know, sleep aid or any of that kind of stuff, because you do fall into another USDA and now FDA regulatory environment. So I wouldn't touch that one if you're not willing to go there. I would look in more closely at the preservation of dried hop binds for the decoration industry. I did some work using various preservatives to keep hops supple and green for a long, long time so they don't dry out. And there's a chap over in England or Wales, I don't remember exactly where, but I know that he grows hops specifically for that purpose. He treats them and he sells them for $400 or $500 a bind because they just last forever.
Yeah. I remember your podcast talking about that. That was really good. But my issue comes down to time, trying to spend the time finding the right looking binds. And time is,
if you are limited to bind number, right. And you know that pretty is more important than, you know, potent, that would drive me to certain hop varieties immediately, mm-hmm. right? So for me up here, it would be Brewer's Gold because it was sexy as hell because it would get cones that were almost an inch and a half in diameter and 3 inches long.
Oh, wow.
And certainly if I let them go to seed, then they would get enormous and people were just, you know, would drop jaws, had big, great looking leaves. It was super downy resistant. And, but nobody, brewers didn't want to touch them.
Sounds like Canadian Red Vine down here.
Yeah, exactly. So those immediately had a different market. So we would sell them to anybody who wanted sexy cones. Mm-hmm. So a lot of florists, you know, we would even get florists asking us in like February, hey, do you have any, you know, we want to make boutonnieres for hops. There's a wedding coming up. They want hops a year, like the wrong time of year. I got nothing. I got dry. They're like, oh, no, we want fresh. I'm like, in February, you're not going to go anywhere on the planet and get fresh hops in February. So, but that was a market where we would sell, you know, whole binds of flowers for garland during, you know, anywhere from serious cone set all the way through harvest for a couple of $100 a bind.
Mm-hmm. I sold my entire harvest mm-hmm. last 2 years. So honestly, do I want to use my cones in brewing or these other avenues, or do I want to cut my binds and make them look pretty? So it's one of those, yeah, I could try and do it if I have the time, but right now, do I really want to? Not at the moment.
That's why I challenge you to say that you want to be all things hops, mm-hmm. but you really only want to be all things hops in the arena that is the most time efficient for you right now.
Correct.
So that's where you focus, mm-hmm. and you let that, if that's a good revenue generator, you let that grow your business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then as I have time, expand it to other areas. Yeah, exactly. All right.
Yep, and it's got to also kind of float your boat. It's got to be fun and stuff you want to be involved in.
I learned a long time ago, so, if you turn a hobby into a job, it's no fun anymore.
Nope.
By the way, James, you mentioned sexy cones a few minutes ago. That's the name of the episode, just mm-hmm. so we're clear.
Nice. Okay, that's fine. I'll try to do something with that bump with a bumper at the end about sexy cones.
So I've got one more thought. Pick y'all's brains a little mm-hmm. bit. So the Mid-Atlantic region is a fledgling hop growing region. There's not a lot of hops being grown. There's several universities testing hops. Not a lot of information being put out. That's part of the reason I try to put all my information out, because there's just nothing out there as a baseline to even start with. So my question is this, you know, or my thought, well, it's not really a question, it's a thought. And so I want to hear what James and you had to think on this. So starting out, I'm pretty confident that the hops industry in the Mid-Atlantic is only going to survive on small scale or micro growers like myself doing half acre, 1 acre, maybe up to 5 acres, and supplying those breweries for one-offs, pilot, or seasonal brews. It's going to be 10 to 20 years, maybe, at the earliest, before we see 20, 50 acres worth of hops once information starts getting correlated and mailed in. Do you concur with those thoughts, or do you have something to add? Or
Greg, you can go first. I'm still
thinking about this. I thought I lost you there. That was so silent.
We're thinking because
I popped your brains.
You know, it's interesting because the appetite to grow big, sometimes it's born of quality and, you know, quality combined with cash. And sometimes it's just cash, as James and I have seen too many times. So I do not think it's going to be that long before you see someone trying to grow to have a 10, 15, 20 acre hop yard. I think that given the preponderance of craft breweries all over the place and hops being a sexy product, you're going to see folks try to do that by you. Whether they succeed or not, that depends on a whole lot of things.
Yeah, I would concur with that. There's always going to be somebody in this industry that is focused more on what the spreadsheet says than what the reality is. And they will be the ones that will be somebody that comes in with money. And I kid you not, in some cases, it's people that say, I need to lose X amount this year.
Mm-hmm.
And people with big pockets. And I've been approached several times to do business plans and economic feasibilities for people with stupid money that say, I need to lose money. How about hops? Okay.
It's a good way to lose money. Right. Farming, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, you could also grow artichokes. I can. How much money do you want to lose? Thank you for being honest with me. But I think that that group that makes that leap is likely to fail. If they certainly are thinking that they're going to be the ones to change the industry and we're going to show everybody how to do this and we're going to, and the next thing they're going to do is they're going to buy all fancy brand new equipment, big professional stuff, because that lends them immediate legitimacy and have no idea how to run it. Then they're going to hire somebody, and this is would be bigger, not like 20 acres, I'm talking like 100 acres. Then they're going to hire somebody to come in who's grown hops some other place because, hey, if you're a hop expert, you're a hop expert, right? And then they're going to give it a go. They're going to make all this hoopla. There's going to be all kinds of publicity. And in 4 years, 5 years, they will fail.
It sounds like we're on similar faults.
Mm-hmm.
I challenge anybody that has grown hops, even for four or five generations in Washington, to come down here and grow that same variety, you know, to the same level that they do up there. It ain't going to happen.
Ask our friends in Michigan. That's all I have to say. see how well that worked out for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've talked about the fact that you can't go to your neighbor's yard and say, you know, give me a blueprint of exactly what you did. I'll do the same thing and have that work. So for all the talk about the Pacific Northwest and how they've got, it's true, they have generations of doing the same thing and all of that, you know, at the school of Mother Nature. But part of their learning was important. What the land has learned over that time is important too. That land has been, you know, generationally designed for hop production. So to your point, there are a lot of things you can learn and a lot of things you can look at, but transplanting, every region is different. And to your point, Mark, it's in its infancy by you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of what we're finding. There are just so few hop yards. And one of the hardest things I'm finding is when you try to email or talk to some of the other growers in the region, other states here in the Mid-Atlantic, it's hard to needle out any kind of information. It's almost as if some growers want to hold on to the information. They think they got some secret there. And it's a shame that we can't share information and coalesce it all together and start finding those threads that correlate and those that don't, so that we can try and help the industry as a whole. That's my problem.
That's why we started Gorse Valley Hops. That's exactly why we started it, because there was very poor information out there, if you could even get it, and then it was likely wrong. Mm-hmm. I went to a little gathering of the Wisconsin Brewers Guild, and there was a guy there who was a beverage industry consultant. And he had brought samples of hops with him and that were grown by a few growers around the state that he had talked just to say, hey, put in these plants and let's just show these brewers that we can grow hops. This is back in 2006. And so I had a brewer friend of mine call me and say, can you come to this meeting? Yep, sure. Happy to. Didn't bring any swag, just showed up. And this guy was 100% full of shit. He had these maps saying, oh, this is all the high phosphorus soil in the state, and this is where you need to grow hops because hops suck up a lot of phosphorus. I'm like, what? Says who? And I just couldn't keep my mouth shut. I'm like, well, what's a lot? Well, you know, they're really phosphorus intense crop. Yeah, what does that mean? You know, of course, couldn't answer anything. And then I'm the asshole, right? So it was at that point when I'm just looking at this brewer, who's a really well-respected brewer, I just am flabbergasted. And he said, what are you going to do about this? And that was, I'm like, I got to do something about this. So that's when we started doing all of our outreach and education, because the information that was out there, even coming from the university folks around here, was bad. because all they were doing was regurgitating whatever information they could get from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. That's what I've been hearing a lot.
And they chase grant money, right? Because hops are sexy. And around here now, hops have gone by the wayside because hemp is sexy. And they're doing the same thing over again. They're just regurgitating information. And nobody's actually applying plant physiology and you know, environmental production practices to what's going on here. So,
you know, you bring up hemp as a left turn here. You know, hemp in Virginia is just now getting started. They loosen the laws. And so many people are like, throwing themselves into this daggone hemp that they want to make these millions. And everyone asks me, why don't you get involved in hemp? And I look at them, I'm like, that is too high risk. I mean, the THC levels have to be at a certain level. And if it's too high, you've got to burn the whole crop. There's no crop insurance. You get paid for none of that. And I said, if they take the testing at a certain point in the weather patterns, it could be higher or lower. You don't know. And I've told some people, I said, you know, hemp and hops are related. And we found in some of our cultivars that the alpha acids are above, way above, even the average percentage. And I wonder if hemp is the same way. I don't know how the alpha acids and THC relate, but I wonder if hemp farmers are going to have a similar issue. And to another point, when all of these hemp growers get involved, and let's say this industry does survive, all of a sudden, the bottom's going to drop out because there's so many farmers supplying so much hemp and CBD oil. How are they going to survive?
The market's already saturated with CBD.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing this. I follow the industry fairly closely. And mm-hmm. I'm going to say it's going to probably be two more years. And unless the USDA and the FDA can agree on quality standards, the market's going to crash. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much CBD crude and refined out there right now that, and no quality standards around it, the processors will not take a chance on a new producer because it's too risky. Mm-hmm. So too bad. So sad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where hops, that's part of the reason I want to stay in hops. It's already set. I cannot go much above what the industry prices are now. Yes, it's local. Yes, it's fresh. Maybe I add a dollar or two per pound when I sell to brewers. Or whatever, but it's pretty much set. I can't go out there and say, hey, buy my hops for $20 a pound when you can go online to, here you go, James, Lupulin Exchange. I know. And buy it for $10 a pound. So, yeah. Yeah, I know.
I got the creepy chills right now. Thank you very much for that. More coffee.
Yeah, I'll go grab you some. Grab you a beer. Calm down.
Okay.
You asked me some questions. I've kind of grilled you pretty good now.
No, please. Well, let's talk. You have any technical questions?
Honestly, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts. You know, this year or this coming season, next season, we haven't been using any pre-emergent herbicides. And this next season, I'm going to be looking into that and trying to find some. It seems like from your podcast and what I've been hearing from some other sources, that's a really good thing to do. So I'm going to be putting that out. This year we trialed a burn back herbicide because last few years we've been hand pruning and I do not recommend that crap.
Oh, what God. Was so, it? AIM?
Yes.
Yeah, no. It's way too expensive. It doesn't work for shit.
Oh, AIM worked great for us.
Oh, it didn't work for shit up here.
Yeah, it worked great. I mean, it's the best stuff since sliced bread for us.
Nope. Yep, wouldn't touch ours.
Wow. Yeah, we used AIM a couple times during the season and we loved it.
I used other things.
Okay, I won't dig into that
one. Yep, mm-hmm. Not on the air.
No. So, yeah, the only two that I know are listed for use in Virginia right now are Scythe and AIM. And okay. I talked to the local university who used Scythe last mm-hmm. year, or the year before, and they had to use a ton of it. It cost a lot. And I said, I'm not using that. I'll try AIM. And we really had good luck with it.
Yeah, pellagranic acid, which is what Scythe is, works pretty well on really tender leaf plants. Something that has a very thin cuticle, which ain't hops.
No, not hardly.
So it takes gobs and gobs of it. And you've heard us talk about Bill, our buddy who bought the Gorse Valley brand. He did side by side with AIM and Scythe and a couple other compounds. And Yeah. I mean, the aim sort of worked for him. The scythe didn't hardly work at all. And some of the other products that, we have access to here in Wisconsin work just gangbusters, but they have very restricted application requirements. But ultimately, when people say, you know, what is a, I've got this hop yard, you know, this is my plan. I'm going through this with my Aussie buddies right now. And, you know, what's your weed control plan? Well, mulch, I'm just going to mulch. Yeah. Good luck with that. I said, is your mulch 6 to 8 inches deep? Because that's the depth that's really effective at suppressing seed germination, but it doesn't stop seeds from germinating in your mulch.
Not only that, but you create a situation with moist dirt around your hop crown and pests and stuff like that, disease.
Correct, right. They're like, we don't have downy, so it's not a problem. Like, yeah, downy's not your only problem. Yeah. So the mulch is fine, certainly in locations in Australia and other points in the world where you have moisture conservation concerns. But as a weed control mechanism in a, I'm going to say, even a small scale commercial hop yard is not an effective strategy. Mm-hmm. So yes, weed control is critical. I applaud you for looking at pre-emergence, and I'm happy to give you any insight I have on them. So
we'll go into the other thing where I emailed you my thoughts on photoperiod and mm-hmm. growing degree day correlation. And mm-hmm. so I've revised that from a theory to a hypothesis.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So, I've reworded it, retyped it a bit, so mm-hmm. put it on our website, make it actually mm-hmm. do a little better. But let's put it on the air. Your thoughts on photoperiod and growing degree day correlation, and you know, you can reference my hypothesis if you'd like.
How deep do we want to get?
How much time do you have?
Because Greg will start drooling again if your email, Mark, prompted a significant back and forth between Greg and myself.
Oh dear.
And I said, and I'll share this, I have no problems. I said, short answer, long answer. Short answer, all right, I'll say this first. Long answer, it depends. Short answer, I think it's bullshit.
Okay.
Now, bullshit only in how I think most people think about the impact of day length and hop flowering and flowering triggers. And it's an easy, the topic, certainly in locations where you've got photoperiods that are different than, you know, the temperate north, it's an easy smoking gun.
I think before you dive too deep, let's explain what this means to the 99% of our listeners who just said, huh?
Nope. So what Mark's talking about is hops are what we call a short day plant. So we have these changes in photo periods. So the length of day, as we know in the Northern Hemisphere, as we approach May, June, our days get longer and longer and longer till we hit the solstice, June 21st, after which point the days get shorter. The amount of sunlight that's incident solar radiation, how's that sound, that is available to hit the plant. That change, that shift in photoperiod, the change in available light over X time, is one of the triggers for plants to flower. Just one. Does all sorts of other stuff because temperature's not reliable. Temperature's not reliable to break dormancy because you could have a really warm winter and you don't want your plants waking up only to get whacked again later by cold temperatures, right? So temperature has a role to play in this equation. And we measure that temperature by what Mark referred to as a growing degree day. So every plant has a base temperature at which when you go above that temperature, physiological things start to happen. And if you're below that temperature, the plant is quasi-dormant. So not really much is happening. And so with hops, it's 55 degrees Fahrenheit. So what we do is we look at how many hours or how many days, you can even do growing degree minutes if you want, plants accumulate these these hours of heat above 55 degrees Fahrenheit, and the higher you go above it, the faster you accumulate them, right? So there's a there's a correlation between growing degree days accumulation and photoperiod. We don't know exactly what that means in hops, because there's several things that photoperiod will trigger. It doesn't just trigger flower formation. Photoperiod is extremely critical, and probably more so critical in hops, in triggering sidearm development. And if you don't have sidearms growing, you're not going to have yield. So that's the number one thing we have to be concerned with, is that just because you've got, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to extend my day length with lights in the hop yard. Why? And is that really what you need to do? The length of day, how many hours that, like in a greenhouse where you've got lights that come on in the morning, they go off and then they come on again at night, right? You're extending the day length. But with hops, for flower triggering, if we're concerned about photoperiod, you don't need to do that. All you need to do is interrupt the long night cycle. And you do that by flashing a light. And it's called photoperiod night interruption therapy. So what you would do, and they do this with poinsettias for Christmas time. So in order to get poinsettias to go from green, which is their normal state, to having their bracts turn bright red, they do photo interruption at night. So instead of dangling lights in your hop yard and keeping them on all night, if there's any truth at all to photoperiod being your critical factor in increasing yields in your regions, all you would have to do is at some point during the night is turn lights on for 15 minutes and then shut them off. That's it. Because there's an enzyme in the plant, phytochrome, and it measures, it's reactive to two different wavelengths of light. And if you want to get really technical, all you need to do is shine one specific wavelength of light, 660 nanometers. And what that does is that shifts this enzyme in the plant to thinking that it's daytime or it's nighttime. So you don't need to actually extend the day saying, okay, my sun's going down at 7 o'clock or 6:30. I've got to turn my lights on and keep them on until 10. If there's any truth at all to photoperiod and hop flowering vigor, you would just need to do night interruption. Because we've seen night interruption work in several other cases on plants that require long days, short nights. But you could be in a position where your days and your nights are approaching, you know, equality, like let's say Hawaii, right? So what you would do is you'd let it get dark and then flash, you know, turn lights on for 15 minutes and shut them off. And that would interrupt that nighttime cycle. So the plant would think it had two short night times instead of one long one.
Are you still
here? I'm furiously taking notes so I know what the heck to put on Instagram about all this.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so the phytochrome is really what you're after. So there's the physiology behind it. And so when I say I think it's bullshit, I think it's bullshit because people want an easy button answer to their low vigor. And what we have seen time and time again is that it's people's production practices that are more heavily influencing their low yields than day length.
Because that is one thing down here we have found. We've tried growing hops without even pruning, starting on April 1st. Mm-hmm. We've done final prunings April 25th, and this year we did April 18th. And our training dates we found about May 8th, 9th, 10th, somewhere around the 10th, 15th seems to be the best training dates. But no matter what, we always get the yields around early July and then late July and early August. There's two different sets. So the other problem with this is that we're finding as these grow, they get about halfway up, and we start seeing a few sidearms on the lower part, but it's flowering as it's growing, and then finally reaches terminal height, maybe 12 feet in some cases, and terminal flower and everything. And so the cones stay tight in close to their vine structures. They don't have many sidearms like the later ones do. So right. That's what I'm trying to figure out. What is causing that? so are the universities and everyone else in this
world. Right. Well, that sidearm development is a auxin response. So if you're not getting sidearms developing, you're not getting the auxin response, which is a plant hormone. And there's multiple reasons for that. Could be multiple reasons for that. One of them is this horticultural aspect of growing degree days and photoperiod, but it's not the only one. Okay. So it's an extremely complicated system. And flowering in a plant is the single most metabolically energetic thing that plant's going to do because it thinks it's going to die. So keep that in mind when we're saying, well, I've got my yield's low, I got to force more flowers. That plant's already being forced about as far as you're going to force it. But I would look at other factors first to eliminate the easy variables before looking for a smoking gun issue. And I personally feel that all this talk around day length extension and photoperiod adjustment is looking for an easy button answer to a very complicated question.
Okay.
That's what I think.
Well, that was 15 minutes. Cool.
Like I said, it depends. I'm more the it depends guy. But I think, frankly, that something most folks in the Mid-Atlantic states aren't looking at that requires investigation is maybe less of the question of photoperiod and more of the question of incident solar radiation. How much sunshine and what quality of light are those leaves getting?
And that is one of the instruments that is on that weather station we have out in the hop yard that Virginia State University is doing. They have the photoperiod and heat levels and everything, sunlight levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's critical. We know from research in Europe on half a dozen different varieties over a span of about 15 years that the same variety grown, 20 miles apart, yeah, there can be some differences due to microclimate, but in general, they look pretty good. But the same variety grown in Kent, England, and Hallertauer, Germany, you look at the differences in alpha acid levels, and what it comes down to is that Kent is cloudier than Germany is. Because if you give the plant the light quality that it wants, no matter where it was located in those trials, they produce the same alpha acids. But if you had 30% more overcast days, your alpha acids suffered dramatically. So what is the role of sunlight intensity and quality on, the physiology of this plant in any given region? And that's not well studied.
Well, I appreciate you giving me all those answers because I may just hold off on putting that out.
you can have a hypothesis. That's fine, right? But what I challenge people to say is, okay, this is your hypothesis. What are you going to do to test it? So what are the factors that you do or don't know about that could also influence these things?
That's a very good question because, I'm not a university level person, so. All of my information and observations are based on a farming level study.
Yep. And that's fine. That's great. Yeah. Because frankly, I'm a big believer in, research and science has to be answerable to the people. And if it's not boots in the dirt impactful, it's just having beers around a fire and having a chat, right? So in this specific scenario with day length, and I know it's super hot topic in the southern part of the U.S. and now in other parts of the world because they think that, that's their smoking gun to improve yields. I think they're going to be upset that it's not the single factor answer that they hoped it would be.
But you just have to be open to new ideas.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So what I would say to you, if you want to try phototherapy on your plants, is not to extend the day length with lights for X number of hours, but to have lights set up and just night interrupt them.
That might be something as finances become more available that I test out and see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and exactly. it doesn't have to be any super special light. It could be a incandescent halogen floodlight that you turn on.
Okay. It doesn't have to reach an entire plant or just like parts of it.
Just parts of it. I know that there was a grower friend of mine out in the PNW that had a motion-activated high output lamp on one corner of his barn. And he always wondered why these certain plants grew differently in a radius around this barn. And it wasn't until we started looking at the light and how often it came on at night, and he was getting night interruption on one section of his plants, and he saw different yield.
Interesting. That may be a neat little test to do down the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Awesome. Well, do you have any more questions for me? Because that pretty much was all my deep questions and thoughts.
That's about all one person can absorb at one time. That was some.
Well, if you're not a superhero, well, I mean, come on.
We're not James.
Yeah, I know. Not everybody can be.
I think I do have a few questions for you. First of all, we want to thank you for some yes. fantastic interaction here, and you know, to our listeners, please let us hear some of your similar experiences if you're running your own hop farm. Questions you've got for Mark or for us. It's great to get another voice on here to drown out our monotony, as well as to just get another set of opinions. But I think we'll wrap it up with a game. We have a little game for you.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Beer or No. And it sounds like you are a beer fan, which is good. So I've made up and or gathered the names of a handful of beers, and they've all got a Virginia theme to them.
Oh, nice.
So I went Virginia here. So you need to tell me if these are actual beers or just shit that I made up.
I better get at least a 3 out of 5 on this.
take away your Virginia card. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're going to do?
So the slogan for Virginia, as we all know, the marketing slogan anyway, is Virginia is for lovers. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me, is there a beer out there called Virginia is for lagers?
Yes.
There is. You might even know this one. It might be local by you. Seven Dogs Brew Pub. It is an American lager. It comes out of Wytheville, Virginia.
I have not heard that one.
Okay, Virginia is for lagers. I was pleasantly surprised to find that one. I thought that was a great name. Yeah.
Well, if these are all Virginia, then Mark's got homework to do. So you're gonna run this off and write them down and give us a feedback on what you find.
I used to be able to say I've been every single brewery west of Richmond, but there's so many popping up now, I couldn't even come close.
Yeah, right.
They are everywhere now. And I love some of the local names that folks come up with. So Virginia is for lagers. I love that one. The next one, is there a beer called Meet Virginia?
I like that. That's a good song. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say no.
That's a stout from Ohio, of all places.
Oh, nice.
Sandy Springs Brewing in Minerva, Ohio.
Well, it's from Ohio, so we'll give you a pass.
Yeah,
I mean, okay, that's not Virginia.
I want to say the band Train is from, for some reason, I think they're a California-based band, but when I saw that was from Ohio, I thought maybe I don't know, maybe it's a local thing for them. But so you're 1-1. Now, the motto, do you know the motto for Virginia?
Oh, God, no. I live in Virginia and don't know it.
So, Sic Semper Tyrannis. Which is thus always to tyrants. So is there a beer out there called Sic Semper Saison?
Huh. I'm going to say yes on that.
There should be, but I made that one up.
Oh, damn.
Now I will say there's a beer out of Norway called Sic Semper Santa.
Okay.
Nice.
Which is a holiday.
I'm going to say that would be a good beer for... like a police force or something like that, a collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Any Virginia brewers out there, there's your name.
Mm-hmm. Sic Semper Saison. I would try that. All right, so you're 1-2. You got some catch up to do.
Uh-huh.
Now, another phrase I ran across as I was Googling, you know, phrases about Virginia was till the cows come home. So that's a very, you know, common phrase to use. How about till the Kolsch comes home?
Ooh. Yes.
I made that one up too. Ooh. Wow. Wow.
Good night, everybody.
You started strong and then we just went downhill from there.
Oh, we did.
There is a till the cows come home. Sweden, of all places. All right, last.
I think you should work for a brewery as a marketing director or something to name their beers, because you do have good names.
Well, thank you. These are fun. These...
Brewers don't like to pay anybody for anything, so.
No, and what we hear very often is that sometimes the name comes before the beer. They think of the name and then they build a beer around it, which is a game we play with brewers sometimes, is we made up these names, tell us what you'd put in that beer. And man, they come up with some weird stuff.
Yeah.
So the last one, so this is your chance to get to 2 and 3. You're at 1 and 3 here. This is, you know, a very common Southern phrase is bless your heart. So is there a bless your heart out there?
Sure, why not? Let's go yes.
So many, I couldn't even select which one to use.
Wow, here. Really?
Oh, really?
Everywhere. Huh. My favorite one, because it was just so bizarre, both the name of the brewery and the beer, is by the Power Outage Brewing Company. I need to know the story behind that name. And they're in Highland Park, Illinois. And it's a James is going to throw up a little now. It's a pale ale with jalapenos and raspberries.
Whoa!
I'd give it a shot.
I've got so many questions about that one. I don't know where to begin.
unless it's hazy or juicy, I'd give it a shot.
Oh, Lord. Well, I got 2 out of 3.
Two,
so
two out of five. You went 2 and 3.
I didn't get stumped.
No. I think we will need to have you on again solely to give you another shot at this.
Oh yeah, I'd love to have another shot at it.
He's got to have more practice, though.
I didn't even get through all my notes. I mean, your state animal is a bat. That alone, I could find 5 beer names.
Why is it a bat?
I don't know. I had much fun researching Virginia for this, and Mark, again, we had a ton of fun having you on. Thank you so much for your perspective and for your questions and for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I've learned quite a bit from your podcast and from our conversations today, and you all are more than welcome anytime to come down to my Hoppler and tell me what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong, and just sit and talk hops over a good beer.
But it's still really fun and worth your attention.